Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
For about 6 hours a day, 27-year-old Matt Fleming is on his bike, riding around Tacoma, screaming at people's houses.
Mothers are the unsung heroes of the world, and you're doing the best job ever!
Thank you!
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect, and if you didn't catch that, he said, Elsa, mothers are the unsung heroes of the world, and you are doing the best job ever! Up until a few weeks ago, Matt was a chef at Hotel Murano in Tacoma. He spoke with Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing.
We kind of bear the brunt of the first wave. The hotel was primarily largely convention-based business. So a lot of our business came from groups of 100 or 250 or more. And when the orders came, that was kind of the first wave. That was all of our business gone.
Matt found himself sitting on the couch at home, unemployed, filled with anger.
And that's the thing. I wasn't angry at anyone. I was just angry at how I lost my job, why I lost my job, the circumstances under which my friends were losing their jobs, everybody. And I wanted to yell. I just wanted to scream at something. And I was like, I bet I could yell at people because everyone else is really angry too. And I bet people would pay me to yell at them. And that's really how it started. I was like, I love riding my bike. And I feel like yelling. I wonder if people would pay me for it.
Matt didn't want to scream hateful messages or anything angry. He wanted to turn his fear and his frustration into something more hopeful. So he set up a profile on Instagram. It's called Tacoma Shoutouts. If you pay him $1, he'll bike to the location you send him in Tacoma, and he'll yell out your message to your intended target.
They miss you! They love you! Tacoma supports you!
I mean, my goals are just to spread positivity, like truly that, you know, the donations are great and the exercise is great, but I truly just want to like make people smile.
Everything is shouted from well over 6 feet away. Sometimes Matt rides in a circle to deliver the longer messages, and he doesn't just accept any messages for $1. He has a few rules that you need to follow.
No racial slurs, no hate speech. I'm not going to go and like, hey, like, you owe me $5. I'm not doing that. I've thankfully never had to enforce it. Everybody gets it.
So far, Matt has made about $500. He's donating all of the money to a local bike shop called Second Cycles, which does a lot of work with the community. Most of the messages Matt delivers are terms of endearment. He sings happy birthday, and he's shouted some things that are a little raunchy.
One was just like so wrong. It was like, you can't do without your balls. And I actually knew the person I was shouting to, and I know a lot of her neighbors.
So you're screaming at the top of your lungs.
Oh, at the top of my lungs. Neighbors come out, and then the neighbors are getting a laugh from it. It's so great. You know, we're social creatures, and right now we're kind of being deprived of this really basic human need, and that's the need for social interaction. Right now, we are missing something in our lives, and this is a way to put it back in our lives in even a small way.
Matt comes home from these rides tired, but completely elated. He's looking to add at least 2 new riders to start shouting in their neighborhoods in Tacoma. Now that most of us are confined to our homes, Matt wants bikers shouting messages of positivity, love, and humor all over the Northwest and the country.
Happy birthday, dear Daddy! Happy birthday to you!
Thank you!
We have all been dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic in our own ways, and the Sound Effect team has been doing our best to try and cover it in a podcast called Transmission. We're working to bring the kind of storytelling we do on Sound Effect to the crisis we're all living through now. Today on the show, we share some of the stories that have stood out to us from the podcast so far. By now, we've all seen those pictures of the virus, a fuzzy little tennis ball with those little sticky outy things all over it. Somebody thought that resembled a crown somehow, which is where coronavirus gets its name. This tiny thing is the enemy. This is what has turned the world upside down. I've gotten kind of obsessed with these malevolent little entities. They're not quite creatures, not quite things. What are they? How do they work? I've talked to a bunch of scientists about this, starting with Harmeet Malik in the Division of Basic Sciences at the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center.
Viruses are parasites that are able to commandeer host cells in order to reproduce themselves.
Are viruses alive?
So the way I prefer to think about it is that viruses are chemical entities which, when they are commandeering host cells, are alive, but perhaps more chemical than biological.
So in a sense, they're born when they invade a cell.
In a sense, they're born when they invade the cell. That's when their life cycle sort of re-triggers itself.
I don't know about you, but that not quite aliveness is something I find really creepy. These inanimate things that only switch on when they're sucking the life out of your cell. It has such a mindless, mechanistic Terminator feeling to it. And I found myself fixating on how this thing does its evil business in our bodies and makes us sick. So to understand that, I went on a little microbiology adventure, and I'm going to drag you with me. Okay? Our first job is, what's a virus made of?
Typically, the virus is actually made up of three components.
There's the inner core of genetic material. In this case, it's RNA. Think of individual strands of an unwound DNA helix. And then there's this hard shell around it made of proteins, which are the big chunky molecules that are the building blocks of biology.
The outer protein shell is called the capsid, but then there is also a shield around the capsid that allows the viruses the ability to infect cells.
That shield is actually a fatty little membrane studded with those sticky outies. Both of those things, by the way, will loom large in our story later on. But first, we know now what the virus looks like to us. So what do we look like to it? Imagine a little movie shot from the point of view of the virus. For this, I enlisted Wes Van Voorhees, professor of medicine at the University of Washington, UW senior scientist Lexi Walls, and Fred Hutch faculty member Jesse Bloom. Okay, movie time. In our opening shot, two people are standing, say, 3 feet apart. One is sick, one isn't, and then the sick one coughs. A little droplet of phlegm flies from Sicko's mouth at about 30 feet a second. It arcs through the air and lands in the other person's mouth. Keep in mind, this is like a one in a billion shot.
You know, most of these viruses fail to end up in a respiratory droplet that lands in someone else's airways, but it can happen.
They would go into your mouth and down your trachea into your lungs.
It's just kind of oozing along in your mucus.
Once it's in your nose or mouth, the virus is basically just along for the ride until it finds a cell type that it's able to infect.
Down the respiratory tract it goes.
So the virus can't really do anything to you until it's gotten into your cells. So it's waiting to make basically a handshake with a protein that's on the outside of your cells in order to get in.
It binds this receptor I'm sure you've heard about called angiotensin converting enzyme 2.
You've heard of that, right? No?
One of the proteins that's on some of the cells in our airways is called ACE2. And that's the thing that this virus binds.
It'll grow in many different kinds of the cells in the body, but because that receptor is expressed a lot in the lung, a lot of the damage happens there.
So remember, the virus is basically lifeless and harmless until it gets inside a cell via that handshake of death. It comes back to those spiky proteins on the surface of the virus. It turns out they are shaped perfectly, exquisitely, to grab hold of those ACE2 proteins on the lung cell.
And so once that happens, the virus is attached to the cell. And the virus does this using a protein called spike. And actually, those of us in Seattle should be really proud, because a lot of the information we know about the spike protein was determined by the lab of David Viesler, who's a scientist at the University of Washington.
I joined David's lab in 2015, and so I've been working on coronaviruses ever since.
Man, you really backed the right horse there.
Yeah.
So those spike proteins lock on to an ACE2 molecule on the cell.
And each of those spike proteins has three grabbers on the end, and each one is able to grab ACE2 receptor. They signal to the cell.
And then there's typically a trigger. So some form of event that allows the spike protein to rearrange.
Sort of get itself through the cell membrane.
And that's the kiss of death for the cell.
And now the virus is inside the cell. And this is where bad stuff starts to happen.
The person we're inside right now has no idea what's going on. They're going to the grocery store and watching Netflix and doing Zoom calls. But inside, this is that key moment when the virus reanimates.
And then it starts making all the different, you know, kind of evil proteins it makes to replicate itself. Once those proteins are made, it sort of takes over the whole cell, shuts down what the cell's normally doing, and turns it into a virus factory.
And here's how that works. The virus's software, its RNA, starts floating around. It bumps into a cellular machine called the ribosome, which normally reads the cell's RNA.
The ribosomes have no idea. They just crank through and make these viral proteins.
Some of those virus parts have chillingly specific jobs. One protein intercepts the cell's calls for help. Another blocks these little snares the cell has to catch viruses before they escape. And then there's the stuff that builds the virus, like those spike proteins and the capsid shell. Those things basically self-assemble.
They essentially go towards the cell membrane and start forming their own viruses that can bud out and leave the host cell.
And as it leaves, the new virus pulls one more cold-blooded trick.
So the virus, on its way out from a cell after going through its life cycle, steals a bit of the host plasma membrane and basically wraps itself in that, cloaks itself, because it does not want the immune system to recognize it as a foreign entity.
It just sounds dastardly somehow, like they just are dressing up in the skin of their victims. I go to dark places. Anyway, the cell keeps pumping out new viruses until it dies, and the viruses fan out to kill again.
And this process happens many times.
Or at least it can. We don't know how many viruses it takes to get someone sick. For a lot of us, our immune system will fight it off before it gets out of control. But in some of us, it just keeps multiplying.
After 4 or 5 days of this process, there's enough viruses that caused enough damage and elicited enough of immune reaction that you start to feel sick.
And so as it repeatedly infects those deep lung cells, they get inflamed, and they basically, your lung fills up with water and inflammatory cells, and then you can't breathe anymore.
And roll credits. This little virus movie, it's pretty dark. It's like one of those films you queue up on Netflix, and then when the time comes, you don't feel like watching something depressing, and so you just rewatch Austin Powers instead. But there are some bright spots, too. Now that we know almost exactly how that protein handshake works when the virus attaches to the cell, we might be able to interrupt it with a drug.
If you can prevent the virus from even entering the cell at the first point, then you've prevented infection. You've successfully done it. So blocking that interaction is of high importance for all of us working in the field.
And another thing, that horrible bit when the virus steals a little bit of the cell's skin and wraps itself up in it, that could be one of the virus's weaknesses. That envelope, remember, is a fatty little covering, kind of like a soap bubble.
This one is really easy to kill. So with things like greater than 70% alcohol, strips off the membrane, very dilute, something like 8 drops of dish detergent in 12 ounces of water kills it, you know, relatively dilute soaps and stuff. So that's an advantage for cleaning it.
When you take a really close look at this virus and you learn all of its diabolical tricks, you can figure out how to exploit them. You need the plans for the Death Star in order to find the weakness. And that takes time. So it only works if, when you have a crisis, people like Lexi Walls and the Wiesler Lab at UW have already been working on it for years.
I think this is showing how important basic science and basic research is, because luckily, a lot of us have been researching coronaviruses for some time, and so that does allow us to hit the ground running. If we hadn't been funding this research when perhaps there wasn't a global pandemic, we would be much farther behind than we even currently are.
That story was mixed by Bethany Denton. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're sharing some of the stories we've produced for our podcast Transmission, covering the coronavirus outbreak here in the Pacific Northwest. The shortage of testing capacity has meant that we don't really know how many Americans are sick or carrying the virus and spreading it to others. That's slowly starting to change, and as tests become more available, some healthcare providers are trying to find the coronavirus in populations most at risk of an outbreak. KNKX's Will James watched one of those efforts in Seattle.
Dave Rodriguez tilts his head back. A healthcare worker in a mask and gown takes what looks like an extra-long Q-tip and sticks it in one of Rodriguez's nostrils. It goes in farther and farther and farther until it goes all the way through the nasal cavity and touches the back of Rodriguez's throat. The whole thing takes about 5 seconds.
So what did the test actually feel like when it was going on?
It stung a little bit. It wasn't bad. Yeah, it wasn't too bad, but it did sting a little bit, yeah.
This test is happening on a Seattle sidewalk, right outside the building where Rodriguez works. He's a case manager for the nonprofit Plymouth Housing. He helps oversee 31 residents who used to be homeless and now live here, but still need a lot of help with everyday life.
So what made you want to get tested today?
There's a chance, given some of the symptoms, that my life partner and her son may have been infected. And so between that and the fact that I have a slight tickle in the back of my throat and have been having sort of hot flashes for a couple of days, she said she'd go ahead and test me.
What made you want to be sure of whether or not you had the virus?
Well, I work with folks who rely on me to be here and be healthy for them. So I just want to make sure I'm healthy.
This is the first outing of a mobile testing clinic meant to detect COVID-19 in some of Seattle's most vulnerable residents and the people who work with them. It's run by a Seattle hospital, Swedish Medical Center, out of a van that used to be a mobile mammogram clinic. The words Swedish Breast Care Express are still emblazoned on the side.
How do you feel now that you've been tested?
Well, it'll be interesting to find out whether or not I've been exposed. I mean, I hope that it comes back negative. But it's sort of nice to know that I can find out.
Rodriguez is told he'll get results in 4 to 5 days. With the test over, he puts a face mask over his nose and mouth and starts shepherding some of his residents through the same process. The reason all this testing is going on here is that Plymouth houses many of Seattle's most vulnerable people.
So I'm Paul Lambros. I'm the CEO of Plymouth Housing. We at Plymouth house over 1,000 folks that have come out of homelessness, and a lot of them with physical, mental health, behavioral challenges. And so we thought if this gets bad, it's really going to affect our tenant population.
Part of that is because a lot of those tenants live in buildings where social distancing isn't realistic.
People have a unit. They may have a microwave or fridge in the room, some little kitchenette, but a lot of them are sharing common bathrooms and common kitchens. So yes, in this building we're in front of today, and why Swedish is out here is because it's a building that we're concerned about.
Another concern is that a lot of Plymouth residents have COPD, diabetes, hepatitis, HIV, conditions that put them at risk for the worst complications from COVID-19. But not many of the people lined up on the sidewalk actually end up getting that swab up the nose. it's a pretty high bar to get tested for the coronavirus.
Can you just say who you are?
Yep, Dr. Michelle Arnold, and I'm the executive medical director of Swedish Rehabilitation and Performance Medicine.
Like a lot of staff here, she's been drafted into the COVID-19 response.
There are some key symptoms that help us drive decision-making around whether testing is imminent. Majority of those are around fever, anything greater than 100.4, acute, uncontrollable, severe cough, and shortness of breath.
That's what healthcare workers look for when they decide who to expend a test on. When Dr. Arnold says this, I'm wondering, wait, what's the point of only testing people who are already sick? If you're sick, you're supposed to be staying away from other people. But there's more and more evidence that people who feel healthy are unknowingly spreading the coronavirus. Aren't those the people we should be looking for?
So that's a great question. We're pretty convinced as well that there is the potential to spread viral particles before showing symptoms. So the most important things that we can do here in Washington State, wash our hands, don't touch our faces, and making sure surfaces in your immediate vicinity that are touched commonly are appropriately disinfected.
In other words, we don't know who's carrying the coronavirus, so we all have to act as if we are.
What made you want to get tested today?
Well, I figured I better because I got COPD. And I go, well, I better play it safe.
Curtis Martin lives in a different Plymouth housing building. His social worker drove him here to get tested because COPD is a respiratory illness that puts him at risk. Martin sits down in a folding chair. A healthcare worker puts a stethoscope to Martin's back and listens for a crackling sound that could indicate COVID-19 in his lungs. Then the healthcare worker slips a monitor on Martin's finger to check his blood oxygen level. It's 96, within the normal range. Martin has no fever. He's told he's not sick. There's no reason to test for COVID-19. He gets up, steps aside, away from people bustling on the sidewalk waiting to get tested.
As someone with COPD, how do you feel about this whole virus?
I'm a little nervous about it. Because I'm like one of the people that are 80 years old and they're croaking once they get the thing. They say you got underlying issues and it settles in your lungs. And COPD's a lung thing. I'm going, oh boy. I even, when I answer my door, I go, just step back a little bit.
He knows he's not in the clear. Even though he's not sick now, someone could give him the virus at any time, even someone who looks healthy. He wishes more of his neighbors got tested.
I couldn't believe out of our building, only two of us showed up. And I'm going, what a bunch of clowns. I go, get tested.
Why do you think only two of you showed up?
I do not know. I figured the whole building should have showed up. I mean, just to play it safe, I'd have booted everybody out of the building. Go get your ass down there.
Swedish ended up testing a few dozen people at this building. The next day, they headed to one of Seattle's busiest homeless shelters, the Downtown Emergency Service Center. Daniel Malone is the executive director. He's been bracing for an outbreak in the homeless population and says he's surprised there hasn't been a sign of one yet. He says maybe that's luck, or maybe it just hasn't been caught in the testing. The mobile clinic ends up testing 18 of his shelter residents and staff for COVID-19. But again, only people with symptoms were tested. I called Malone afterward.
So they were really only testing people who were sick. I wonder how you feel about that, because at this point, we know now that people are carrying the disease without any symptoms. So yeah, are you concerned about that at all?
Yeah, totally. You know, it's entirely inadequate. The whole testing regime nationwide is inadequate. Yeah, it just feels like we're sitting ducks here, where we've got people who have symptoms and other people who don't have symptoms but might already carry the virus. And it's impossible to know, you know, when we're going to get out of that dynamic.
Malone's hope is that he can find a way to move all of his shelter residents to hotel and motel rooms where they can be isolated. And it won't matter whether they've been tested or not.
That story from KNKX's Will James. This is Sound Effect. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're sharing stories of how people in the Northwest are getting by during the coronavirus pandemic from our podcast, Transmission. One of the ways that hospitals have been preparing for the surge of COVID-19 patients is by cleaning the place out as much as possible, delaying things like elective surgeries. But those measures have costs, too. Elective procedures aren't just facelifts and wart removals. For Allison Krupnik, it meant postponing her cancer surgery. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing checked in with her as the situation developed over a couple of weeks and found it has been an emotional roller coaster.
Before everyone in Washington state was ordered to stay in their homes, except for going out to get medicine, groceries, or exercise, I met up with Allison Krupnik at her place in Ballard. She was coming off of a really busy couple of days. She and her husband were in the process of figuring out how to bring their two daughters home from college. One goes to school in Los Angeles. The other is abroad in Oxford, England.
So there's just been a lot of logistics, you know, college boxes, airline reservations, work things.
On the home front, the family's beloved tabby cat named Cheeto is in the process of dying from kidney failure.
The cat hasn't eaten for days, and he's also not drinking. I mean, we know how it ends, mm-hmm. So I think we feel like let him go gently.
Yeah.
Boy, that's not easy.
Cheeto's condition is stressing out his buddy, an adorable little black dog, a Havanese named Kobe.
My dog and my cat are really close. We call them the brothers, and so he's been keeping a little vigil.
And on top of all of this, Allison was recently diagnosed with early-stage cervical cancer. Before COVID-19, she was scheduled to have surgery to remove the cancer, a robotic hysterectomy, a fairly simple procedure. A few weeks ago, Allison got a call confirming that her surgery was still on for the following Monday.
And then on Friday, I was out doing some work, and I got a call from my doctor's office saying it's been canceled. And I talked to someone in surgery, and it was really moving. So it was the one and only time that I've cried. I started crying, and I said, wait, I have cancer. At one point, I talked to one of the surgery scheduling nurses. I'm not sure what his position was, and he was really upset. And he said, we've been told, you know, urgent and emergency cases only. Your case feels urgent to me. Let me check in with my supervisor. Then he called me back and he said, you know, my heart just hurts for you, but, you know, this is what we're being told.
Again, Allison's cancer is in a very early stage.
I did communicate with my doctor yesterday, you know, who, you know, both reassured me that I have time to play with and also, you know, reiterated the sobering reality that we see in the newspapers every day, that our hospital systems are strained, overburdened. There are people in much worse straits than I am who are also having their procedures deferred, and it's a wait-and-see game.
Guidelines on how to support hospitals dealing with the surge of COVID-19 patients are laid out in a recent article put out by the Journal of the National Comprehensive Cancer Care Network. Members of the network include the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, UW Medicine, and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. The article acknowledges the obvious, that under normal circumstances, cancer surgery is not considered elective. The article says that patients currently undergoing treatment for malignant tumors should continue with their care. But the doctors who wrote the piece also go on to say this. Beyond the care of the individual patient, oncology clinicians will face the heavy reality of rationing care. As the pandemic progresses, there will come a point when channeling a large amount of resources for an individual patient will be in direct conflict with the greater social good. The article cites a recent study from Wuhan, China, that followed a small group of cancer patients there. It says out of 32 cancer patients who were seriously ill with COVID-19 and who required mechanical ventilation, only one survived. Allison has been reassured that time is on her side. She's been told that she has months, if not a year. But she does worry about her cancer getting worse as she waits to hear when she'll have surgery.
I was going to have a simple procedure with a pretty simple recovery and, you know, some hope that I was then done with this cancer. It does make me nervous that if I have to wait too long, and I don't know what too long really is, you know, then maybe the surgery and the treatment that I'll need will have to be more complex and involve greater hardship on my body and greater recuperation. So that's something that I worry about.
About a week has passed since Allison and I chatted in her living room with her dog, Kobe, nearby. I checked in with her remotely 2 days ago. Both of her daughters are home. Cheeto, the family's beloved tabby cat, has died. Overall, Allison is doing okay, but COVID-19 is starting to hit closer to home.
Today was the first day that someone I knew was diagnosed or announced that they were diagnosed. I mean, that's going to happen to all of us. Right before that, I had read that the celebrity chef that I like had died. And so I was upset about that. Then I got the news that a former Foreign Service colleague of mine has been diagnosed. And I just was so sad.
Allison is now a cheerleader for social distancing in pursuit of flattening the curve.
The one clear path that I see, that I think, you know, experts see, to giving us a chance to get a handle on this and free up the resources that are needed for our hospitals to treat not just the COVID-19 patients, but others as well.
Yeah, and when we can flatten the curve, that means you'll have more clarity for when you can get surgery.
Me and other people who are even worse off than me, because I think, you know, anecdotally, I've heard we've gotten to the point where there are people in more acute situations who are also being asked to wait.
Yesterday, I got a text from Allison that said this. Just got word, surgery is back on.
So out of the blue today, when I was right in the throes of lots of busyness through work, I got a call from my doctor's surgery scheduler saying, hey, guess what? We have a possibility of 2 surgery dates for you. Which one would you like?
I'm very happy for you, Allison.
Yeah, let's hope I don't get coronavirus between now and then. You know there's that possibility, right?
You need to stay inside.
I know.
And not...
My husband just gave me a talking to and said...
Her surgery is scheduled for April 8th. At this point, it's not completely clear why it's moving forward, but for now, it's on the books. Allison is relieved and grateful that her doctor is making this happen. The procedure is not taking place at Swedish Medical Center as originally planned. Allison is going to be operated on at Evergreen Hospital, a facility that has cared for the bulk of the region's COVID-19 cases. She feels a little bit like she's walking into the lion's den, but she trusts her doctor. She's trusting the system.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Since that story first aired, Allison had her surgery, and it was a success. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today we are sharing stories from our podcast Transmission, where we've been covering the COVID-19 outbreak here in the Pacific Northwest. When a person infected with COVID-19 dies, those precious final moments aren't spent with loved ones at the bedside. They're spent surrounded by doctors and nurses dressed head to toe in protective gear. One nurse at a hospital in Issaquah, east of Seattle, wanted to do what she could to connect a mother and daughter one last time. Here to help tell the story is KNKX's Kari Ploeg, and she explains who we're going to hear from in this story.
I recently spoke with a woman named Michelle Bennett, who lost her mother to COVID-19. She lives in the east side of the Seattle area. And she has a pretty heart-wrenching story about saying goodbye to her mom. Her mom's name is Carol Ann Gann.
And this story kind of gets at some pretty important stuff about some of the really difficult aspects of this pandemic. Can you just give us a sense of, you know, what piece of this we're touching today?
Yeah. So this story is also about sort of the people who are stepping in and standing on the bedsides of patients who are dying in isolation and doing some of the things that loved ones wish they could do themselves.
All right. So who are we going to hear from first, Kari?
First, we're going to hear from Michelle Bennett.
I want people to know that she was an amazing survivor, resilient, smart, and very funny. She was very charismatic, and She loved her kids and her grandkids. And I am still struggling that I can't just pick up the phone and call her and talk with her, you know?
Hi, Michelle, it's your mom. It's 7:30 on Friday night. I'm just getting off work. I have not bought Tommy's present yet, so I want to know, what does he want for his birthday? What's he into? What's something I could get?
Carol Ann Gann survived a lot, starting from a very young age in Long Beach, California. She lived through an unspeakable act of violence committed by her father.
Her mother and father were in a domestic violence situation. She had left him, and he had found her in California and broke into the house, or came into the house, and killed her. The police report says when they arrived, the toddler was crying over the mother's body. So I can't imagine, you know, what that would have, you know, been like for my mom to be scarred with that at, you know, 15 months old.
After her father was sentenced to life in prison for murdering her mother, Carol Ann was adopted by a loving family, but it was still hard for her to feel safe. Carol Ann survived repeated kidnapping attempts from her biological father's family. She would fall asleep watching the door, fearful someone would take her. But Carol Ann survived it all, something Michelle admires the most about her mom. Carol Ann later attended college part-time while raising 5 children. Michelle says her mom worked hard and never lost her sense of humor.
I was talking to my dad the other day. He goes, you know, the whole time she was in college, I don't think I ever saw her study one time. And she like aced every test, and it was so frustrating. And she was wickedly smart and wickedly funny. And, you know, I miss just being able to talk to her.
Because she was so smart and charismatic, Carol Ann's decision to move to a nursing home in Issaquah was emotionally difficult. Michelle says her mom struggled with COPD and early stages of heart failure. Carol Ann was a nurse for 38 years, so as hard as it was to make the transition, she knew it was the right move to get the care she needed. When Carol Ann told Michelle that someone at her nursing home had tested positive for COVID-19, Michelle says she wasn't worried. Her mom spent most of her time away from common areas, inside her room, laughing with her roommate Pam. Still, Michelle knew the risks.
This is the one disease she needs to stay clear of, because it preys on vulnerable people, and she has lung issues and heart issues, and I think if she gets this, she won't survive it.
Then the call came.
I'm Michelle, it's your mom, and I just found out at 4:00 this afternoon that I do have the coronavirus. I'm positive. So I don't know how many people, but a few years did.
Michelle's heart sank. She sat frozen, knowing what this news likely meant. When she learned her mom was being transported to Swedish Hospital's Issaquah campus, Michelle wanted to see her, even if she couldn't get close.
So I actually drove to the nursing home, keeping a distance, just to catch a glimpse of my mom, maybe in the parking lot. Unfortunately, I had just missed her. They had just rolled her back inside. I think I was so distraught driving there, I took a couple wrong turns. So I got there a little later than I would have. So I'm still bummed that I didn't get to at least, you know, wave to her from a distance.
The next call came from an ER doctor in the middle of the night.
She was so kind. You know, she said, listen, you know, your mom's oxygen levels are really low, and we need to decide whether to intubate her. But if we intubate her, she will probably never, ever come off ventilation. And if we don't, she probably won't make it. And she goes, you know, if it was my mother, I wouldn't have her suffer longer by being on a ventilator. I would, you know, just do comfort care. And it was, you know, that phrase, you know, if it was my mom, like the compassion of internally knowing that pain and empathizing, you know, just the empathy from the ER doctor was amazing. And so that was a really difficult conversation. We were able to get all of my siblings on speakerphone. We were all able to say goodbye, and, you know, we're crying. And my mom said, well, I guess I did something right. You're all on the phone, and look at all of you. And so, you know, she hung up, and, you know, I was just up most of the night waiting for that phone call. And I'm sure it's the hospital. I'm like, okay, here's the call. It's coming. And it's my mom. She's like, well, so I spent the night here, and then, you know, this is what I'm eating for breakfast. And, you know, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you have 9 lives. This is unbelievable. I cannot believe we're just having this conversation. It was such an amazing relief, and unbeknownst to me, short-lived, right? This is apparently, from what's been explained, 2 phases of the disease, you know, so we had kind of gotten through the first, and then the respiratory issues hit, which I didn't understand.
Michelle had gotten used to her mom's knack for surviving the unthinkable. But this new strain of coronavirus is lethal. Carol Ann's health took a swift turn.
You know, over the next 5 days, she just deteriorated and was agitated and, you know, kind of fighting, I think, in her own way for her life by pulling out her IVs and tired of being poked and prodded. And
so our care was primarily focused on making her feel safe and feeling comfortable.
Tatiana Huber is a charge nurse at Swedish Issaquah. She's part of the team of doctors and nurses who cared for Carol Ann in her final days. Tatiana started her shift at 7 o'clock the night of March 25th.
It was a stressful start of the shift. We had been working on a new unit that was dedicated to caring for patients who have the coronavirus, but ultimately we were all just working together and pulling together until things started to slow down and we realized that it was time to start reaching out to Michelle.
So the nurse said, listen, I will take my phone in there and I'll FaceTime her, I'll get suited up and you guys can see her.
Tatiana, dressed from head to toe in protective equipment, held Carol Ann's hand and stroked her hair. She did everything Michelle wanted to do herself. Then the nurse held her personal cell phone up to Carol Ann's face.
And I was telling her I love her and, you know, I miss her. And I could see my mom like kind of just moving her lips. Like, I think she really heard me. She just couldn't respond. And that meant so much to me. Like, that's the memory I get to carry, that I did see her. Whether she knew I was physically present or not, she heard my voice. I saw her face. And for that nurse, I am forever grateful that she allowed me that opportunity.
At hospitals around the country, nurses and doctors on the front lines of the coronavirus response are the only people present when a critically ill patient takes their final breath. Michelle says she knows that isn't easy for people like Tatiana. But in the face of that tragedy, they're standing in for loved ones who don't have the choice.
These folks, these nurses, this healthcare staff, they have to endure this pain as well. Like, they're the last conduit of life. And she said, your mom will not be alone. I said, you promise you'll stay in there? She said, yes, we will be here with her. So she held her hand and she was able to rub her head and things that I wanted to do so badly and my siblings did too, and we couldn't. She stayed with her till the end.
So I stayed with her as long as I could. And what we would do is we would just kind of around, be close to her and still talk to her. That way she could hear us and know that she wasn't alone.
More and more people are saying goodbye to their loved ones this way, as the coronavirus spreads and forces people to spend their final moments in isolation. Moments that are important for resolving regrets of the past.
And what I realized, I was talking to a couple of close friends in between these phone calls. They said, you know, your mom needs to hear you say you forgive her, and your mom needs to hear you say that it's okay to go. And so the very last phone call, I said, you know, Mom, I forgive you from the things we were talking about, and it's okay to go. You can go. And then an hour later, she left. So I think she kind of needed permission, you know, and then just told her how much I loved her.
Michelle says without that last conversation, her mother, the everlasting survivor, would have kept struggling to hold on. Michelle says Tatiana gave her mom the opportunity to let go. Tatiana had lost one of her sisters a few years ago. She knows the grief a person feels when those important words go unspoken.
It's difficult to describe the pain and the regret and all the things that you'd like to say to someone that you love, but you weren't able to. And it was important to give them this one last conversation before it was too late.
Tatiana says she wishes she could have granted such a moment the privacy it deserved, but she's honored she was able to connect mother and daughter one last time.
Honestly, all I wanted to do was just reach through the screen and just hug her. Just hearing her last conversation with her mom, it was such a powerful discussion about love and forgiveness and letting go. It was just the greatest thing that she could have given to her mom. And all I wanted to do was hug her and comfort her too.
Do you think that you'll get an opportunity to comfort Michelle and give her that hug? I think she wants to hug you as well.
As soon as social distancing allows us to hug, there is nothing that I would love more than just to meet her and hug her.
Michelle has started a crowdfunding campaign to raise money for King County nurses like the ones who helped her mom in those final days. She's looking forward to the day she can meet Tatiana and express her gratitude in person. Do you know if and when you'll ever get to meet these nurses and say thank you in person?
I want to see them so badly and just hug them and just give them the world if I could, honestly. Like, those are the heroes, really. You know, those are the heroes of this tragedy.
What do you want her to know if she's listening right now?
Michelle, you did the greatest thing that you could have done for your mom. You gave her the permission that she needed to relax and let go. And I really want to thank you for your selflessness in that moment and giving that to her. I can only imagine how difficult it must have been to have that conversation through a cell phone screen instead of being able to hold her and touch her. But I want you to know that we kept her as comfortable as she could, and we wanted to make sure that she didn't feel alone.
Thank you for being there with my mom. Thank you for not letting her die alone. I appreciate you so much. Thank you for being who you are and for taking a personal investment in someone you didn't have to, and for giving her family closure. That means more than we can possibly express.
That was Michelle Bennett and the story from KNKX's Kari Ploeg. Before we go, I just wanted to share this music with you. It comes to us from students in the band at Graham Kapausen High School in Pierce County. Band director David Stewart had each student record their own part on a mobile device like an iPad, synchronized to a click track that keeps tempo. And then he mixed it all together. So here's Canzone per Sonar No. 2 by Giovanni Gabrielli. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Will James and Kari Ploeg. Florangela Davila is our executive producer. Be sure to subscribe to both our Sound Effect and Transmission podcasts. They're available everywhere you get your podcasts, including NPR One, Spotify, and Stitcher. And be sure to rate and review them both. It really helps. That's especially helpful on Apple Podcasts. You can also send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. And follow us on Facebook. Stay safe out there, and be sure to tune in next week when our theme is Revising History. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.